Okay, folks, you're listening to the latest, and I hope the greatest, you know what they say, that, you know, you've got to keep up your standards and all that kind of stuff. Latest edition of Life on Planet Porky, with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, writing into another new year with another new book coming up, I'm told. It's Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, how are you this morning?
I'm very well, Michael. How are you doing today?
Yeah, pretty good. You know, looking forward to, getting back into the cut and thrust of work as life picks up again after the happy holidays, as they call it these days. But I shouldn't think that you're going to be quite as communicable as you've been in the past, Ms. Jones, because your ancient BlackBerry phone is now doomed to extinction, isn't it?
Well, it's not that ancient, first of all. The BlackBerry passport, which I have, it's one that's not been around all that long. I know that BlackBerry are winding down. They've talked in the past, and I'm still hopeful that they might find an investor and that they might go forward and not actually shut down completely. But at the moment, it's only the older BlackBerries that are being decommissioned. I think that BlackBerries in general are said to, they're going to cease functioning reliably from the 4th of January. So we'll have to see what happens. Yeah. I am an Apple refusenik.
Yeah.
I don't want an iPhone. I know there are lots of other phones you can get. It's just that, you know, you get used to something.
Sure.
And it works the way you need it to work.
Yeah.
And you don't need something all singing and all dancing that 90% of its functions you wouldn't use anyway. Mm. I've always found it very reliable. And also BlackBerries traditionally are unhackable.
Oh, really? Yeah.
That's a very useful function to have. So
yeah,
let's see. I'm going with the flow at the moment because I haven't really got time to learn a new phone, as they say.
No, I totally agree with you. I've had to adapt to every phone I've had throughout my life. You know, it's always been updated from the previous one. Like you, I don't use an iPhone. I use a Samsung, but I'm very happy with it. My last three or four phones have been Samsung. So, oh no. I had a BlackBerry years and years ago. And in those days, it sat in a cradle on my desk at my office. And you know, you took it out and you took it away and used it, and it had like buttons on it, which you don't see anymore, of course. And it was a sort of weird little instrument. Does yours still look like that? Has it got little buttons on it?
No, they look more like sort of mini tablets now.
Right.
Like a little, you've seen mine, little computer type thing.
Right.
They don't have a rollerball. They do have a keyboard. And that is the crucial element for me. I don't like stabbing away at numbers on a screen.
Yes.
I prefer to tap numbers like a typewriter.
Oh, right.
That's just my mentality.
Yeah, that's fine.
I'm happiest in front of a keyboard.
Yeah.
I don't like tapping away on screens. So let's see what they come up with. You never know. There might be a sort of last minute turnaround.
Yeah, sure. No, I totally agree. I mean, like you, I wish that actually a phone was just something you carried around to be able to talk to other people with, or maybe send them a message. All the other functions to me are nebulous. And, you know, it's got me into so much trouble over the years, having the ability to contact people, including the whole of the rest of the world, through Twitter at an instant's notice. I wish it had never been devised, honestly. Life for me was much, much simpler when I was a reporter on the Birmingham Evening Mail, and the only way you could contact anybody was going to a phone box and ring them. You know what I mean? Life seemed a lot less complicated in those days, believe me.
I know what you mean, but I managed to get around that by not having Twitter on my phone.
Oh, good, thank you.
Because it's too distracting.
Yeah.
You know, there are too many opportunities, especially if you've been in a bar, had a couple of drinks. Mm. And I've been in this situation where I've gone onto Twitter and tweeted something that the next day I've really regretted.
Yeah, sure. I totally agree.
And so, not that I'm a lush or anything, but every now and again, you know. So.
Yes, absolutely.
Also, it's very distracting. Mm. Twitter is very time consuming. Mm. You can sit for hours on it.
I totally agree.
Keep it on my desktop and I visit. Yeah, when I'm working at my desk around the clock, it's quite nice to have that little distraction.
Yeah.
You can go in there a couple of times a day and just communicate with a couple of people. Mm. But if you have it on your phone, it's there all the time. And the temptation is too great. Social media is a great thief of my time.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with them, you said. So there you go. At the very start, I couldn't work out why anybody would want to put a camera into a phone. I thought, well, it's a phone. It's not a camera. Why are people putting... But now I couldn't live without it because, you know, if you've got a document that you've got to sign and send back, or if you need evidence for something, you know, a car crash or something like that, it's absolutely invaluable. valuable having a camera in your pocket all the time. But again, it's the modern age. Talking about the modern age, Miss Jones, because of course you are a loyal and devoted church warden at St Bride's. I've read a report this week that 400 churches have closed down over the last decade, and that saddens me greatly because, A, you know, I don't want people to stop worshipping whichever religion that they follow, but B, I love churches as buildings, as architectural, you know, magnifiques, and I don't like to see them being turned into supermarkets and nightclubs and all this kind of thing.
It is a shame. Christianity is still the biggest religion in the world, yep. Believe it or not. Yep. More than a third of all people on earth still follow it.
Golly, that's amazing.
But yes, the parish church has been a victim of declining congregations.
Yeah.
I felt a bit uneasy when they started selling off churches and you could buy one and live in it.
Yes.
But I think that's rather better than turning it into a shop or a bingo hall or something like that.
Yeah, I agree. I can't stand to see a church be anything other than a church. I agree with you. When I worked on the Express in Fleet Street, you know, one of my reporters came in one morning, very pleased, just bought his first new flat. And I said, oh, where was it? And it was a church that had closed down in Islington. And he bought the top floor flat, almost like in the Belfry, you know what I mean? It's been converted into flats. And I would never go there. I feel churches are still consecrated land, and I don't like to, you know, be sitting in a converted flat in a church with a circular window and all the stonemasons' work around it and all that, drinking a few glasses of wine. I feel it's wrong.
It's not just about the land, though, is it? You know, the walls of those buildings, they seem to be imbued with the spirits of thousands of people who've been christened there, married there, who've been... they've had their funerals there, some of them been buried there.
That's right.
All of that energy is all still in those walls.
Yeah, yeah.
And that makes it a very different type of place, not something that you could necessarily live in.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I read also, by the way, that in this week in 1538, the Church of England was formed. In 1538, Henry VIII self-declared supreme head of the Church of England and was excommunicated by Pope Paul III. Isn't it amazing to think that the church you've just been talking about, one third of the people in the world follow Christianity, the Church of England within that was created because the King of England wanted a divorce?
Yeah, but it's still Christianity, isn't it? It's a variation on the same theme.
Yes.
This actually all started with a different pope, wasn't it? It was Pope Clement the Seventh.
Golly, your knowledge of religious affairs is way above mine, Miss Jones. But then again, you are a very clean living lady, of course.
Well, I don't know about that, but this was to do with the fact that Catherine of Aragon informed the Pope that Henry said he was going to take a second wife, which is, of course, Anne Boleyn. Mm. And so the Pope did warn Henry that he couldn't do this, and he would declare Henry's marriage to Anne Boleyn null. Henry ignored the warnings, and the excommunication threat was suspended for a while. But Henry, of course, didn't toe the line, so the Pope sacked him. Incidentally, when I was looking up about this, I didn't know this. Henry VIII, this is terrible, you know,
right.
He dug up and burned the bones of St. Thomas of Canterbury and scattered the ashes to the winds, proclaiming that the saint was a traitor.
Really?
I never knew this. I thought that Thomas's remains were in Canterbury Cathedral.
So did I. And in fact, I think I've seen them. I went to a wedding once in Canterbury years and years ago, and we had a couple of hours to spare, you know, before the wedding. So instead of languishing in the pub, we thought we'd go and have a look around. I could swear I saw a plaque on the wall inside Canterbury Cathedral saying, here lie the remains of, the saint who founded Christianity in this country.
Well, I think what we've seen is a plaque, because I've seen it as well.
Yeah.
But I don't think there are any remains behind it, which is a bit worrying, isn't it?
It is a bit worrying, I have to say, yeah. But anyway, there you go. Who will rid me of this, what was it? What was the word in the Shakespeare play? Who will rid me of this troubled priest or something? No, who will rid me of this troublesome priest? That was it, wasn't it?
Somebody will tell us, no doubt.
Yeah, of course they will, yeah. And then, of course, the king's favourite knights thought that the king was giving them a sort of nod and a wink. Can you go and get rid of him? and rode off down to Canterbury and unfortunately massacred him, for which the king regretted for the rest of his life, didn't he? But anyway, look, that's a history lesson which I'm sure our listeners do not need. They probably know more about it than we do. Absolutely right.
They will let us know. Yeah, I know.
Oh, they will. They always do. Now, one of your friends from the past, Miss Jones, and I mean this in the strictly professional sense, was Mr. Bill Wyman. You reported on things he did and followed the stones and all that. I think you're writing a book at the moment, which might include some activities of Mr. Wyman. But I read a piece just recently saying that Bill Wyman, can you believe this, has got every Rupert Bear annual since they were first published in about 1937 or something, that he's a fanatical collector. Oh, yeah, the first one appeared in 1936, and he's got every one since. And even now, his children and his children's children read all these Rupert Bear annuals, because apparently Bill Wyman is a fanatical collector of all sorts of things, including the Rupert Bear annual.
It's very odd, isn't it? I mean, he is the collector of the stones. Right. He collected every single ticket, all the little button badges,
yeah,
all the programs, the bits of merchandise, every DVD, every photograph.
Yeah.
He's got vast archives of all this stuff.
Mm.
And you have to question it in a way.
Yeah.
Why did somebody spend their life amassing stuff?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and what's he going to do with it now that he's gone 80 and he's not going to live forever? What do you do with all that stuff?
Well, they say that it's worth millions. Yeah. I can't actually see that it is, because if you were to open a Rolling Stones museum or a Bill Wyman museum or something,
yeah,
that only has a finite level of interest, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's a fascination. I mean, is there, for instance, an Elvis Presley museum?
Well, there is, of course, Graceland.
Yeah.
We're in Tennessee, where you could go and visit. This is Elvis's home. He's buried there. His parents are buried there.
Yeah.
It's the home he lived in. So you can visit these rooms and see exactly how he lived and so on.
Yeah.
His costumes and his cars and all that kind of stuff. Everybody's been there. Mm. Presidents of the United States, William and Kate have been there.
Yep.
Eugenie and Beatrice have been there. It's one of the most visited places on the land.
Yeah.
In the world, I should say.
Yes, and
I think that every figure, every sort of major rock star or whoever else that people want to carry on having connection to after they've died, they need to have a shrine.
Mm. Well, every president's got a shrine, of course, in the United States of America. As soon as the president leaves office, they then give him like 20 million quid to found a presidential library where all the papers of his presidency go and all that kind of stuff. I've been to Jimmy Carter's in Atlanta, Georgia, the one for George W. Bush is being built at the moment in Texas. So I understand that completely. And of course, much closer to home, how many Beatles museums are there in this country? There's at least three, aren't there?
Well, yeah, not only that, but because the National Trust snapped up Paul McCartney's childhood home.
Oh, yeah.
They took on John Lennon's childhood home. People have said it's disgraceful that they didn't take on the houses in which George Harrison and Ringo Starr were born, for example. But the National Trust explained this. Songs that have gone into the national consciousness and are of great historical worth were written in those houses, which is why they took them on. But George and Ringo didn't write any songs in their houses, so that makes the difference, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that there should be shrines for people like David Bowie and Freddie Mercury. I think the fans deserve somewhere to go and worship.
Yes.
With John Lennon, we've got, of course, the Strawberry Fields Memorial in New York.
Yes, yes.
But fans of Freddie, fans of David, many other artists don't have anywhere they can go to pay their respects.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And the other interesting thing is that, and we've talked about this, we've touched on this before, but it's now increasingly common. The back catalogues of great stars are being sold. Only this week, as you and I are recording now, David Bowie's was sold for about 118 million, I think, which I didn't think was an awful lot, considering that Bruce Springsteen's went for 300 million. But that is the common trend, isn't it? Huge companies now buying up the back catalogues of all these stars.
And the interesting thing, I did some radios about this yesterday, actually, and there are furious debates raging on Facebook about it. There is a vast misunderstanding out there as to what this is about. There is a massive difference between the recordings of an artist and their publishing, which is the songs that they wrote. And this is what we're talking about in this instance. It's nothing to do with recordings, the actual things you've heard on the radio over the years of David Bowie's. This is to do with the very songs that he wrote. Those pieces of paper with the lyrics on and the rudimentary melodies, the chords and everything.
Sorry, isn't that the same thing? Isn't the song and writing of it the same thing?
No, of course not. No. The song is, say you sit in your bedroom and you come up with a song and you write down the words and you put a few chords to it and you write the chords down as well. That is your song. The recorded version of it is when the artist and their musicians have gone into a studio, they have laid down this track, they've cut it, they've got arrangements, they've got instruments, they've got other musicians involved, they've got backing vocalists, and everything that ends up on that recording is called a master. And that master is owned by the record label who actually took them on to record them in the first place. So these are two completely different things. What we're talking about this week is David Bowie's songwriting publishing, which is not the same thing as his recorded songs.
And that presumably is a profit motive, is it? If you own...
No, I don't think so. I think what's happened here is that there are inheritance tax bills to pay. And before everybody jumps up and down and says, Iman doesn't need the money, Duncan Jones, David's son, definitely doesn't need the money. How much money, more money do they need? We don't know what kind of inheritance tax bills they might be facing.
No, I totally agree. And anyway, you can't take it with you. And I, you know, I don't mean that glibly, but if it's not decided before you die, there's going to be a dispute and an argument over who gets what.
It's not really about that. So, for example, it's much easier to leave your heirs, your estate, say, for example, £100 million. It's easier to leave that chunk of money than it is to leave them the rights to that artist's song publishing, because every single song generates a different sum of royalties every year. So that takes an expert to unravel all of that, to calculate it year by year, and to pay it out to whoever has inherited it. It's much easier to consolidate it, sell it to somebody who knows what they're doing with it, like Warner Chappell Music in this case, and let them get on with it, and then pay the tax during your lifetime and enjoy the rest of the money. But where this is going wrong with so many artists that have now jumped on this bandwagon is that private equity firms are snapping up the rights to these publishing royalties. And they are doing it in a mercenary way, just for the money that they can make. So suddenly we will start to hear songs by artists cherished down the years, used to sell things like Viagra or nappies or sofas on television, as Freddie Mercury songs are being used for now. And I personally don't think that that's what that music is for.
No, and I don't think it's what the original artist would have wanted, is it? You know, I mean...
No, of course not. Because, you know, David Bowie was a control freak. All rock artists are control freaks. That's part of their essence. It's part of what they do. So if they didn't want their song to sell a sofa in their lifetime, why would they want it after they've died?
Well, no, I totally agree. So staying on the musical theme, and of course we can't have a podcast without mentioning the Beatles, our favourite subject, which our audience would want us to. How did I see a headline in the Daily Telegraph of all newspapers, probably, you know, one of the most respected newspapers in the world, a headline this week which said, Beatlemania is going to be this year's big fashion trend. What does that mean?
I mean, have they been asleep for the last 50 years?
I've no idea. Does it mean we're all going to have Beatle haircuts or something and start wearing suits, you know, without collars and all that kind of stuff? I mean...
I don't think it is. No. I think it's to do with Get Back and you know, the whole Let It Be furore and all of that. It just means that they're having yet another new lease of life. And how fantastic for us.
I totally agree. One of the things about me having to stay at home at Christmas, because obviously I got the COVID and couldn't go off to see the family in Bournemouth, which we've talked about, but I managed to get stuck into those Beatle tapes. I think one of the most amazing things I've ever seen on, in you know, the form of pictures and words is watching Paul McCartney with his bass guitar putting together Get Back from Nothing. It was mesmerising. Have you seen those tapes, Leslie Ann?
I've been saving them because, as you know, I've been immersed in writing a book.
Yeah.
So I decided to save the whole experience and do it at the end.
Yeah. Well, no, you won't be disappointed, honestly.
Losing my voice here. I have to cough.
Oh, don't worry. I've got a bit of that this morning, but that's because as we're recording, it's suddenly gone very cold from being very mild over the last few days, and that gets you in the throat. Just touching on McCartney just for a moment, and then, folks, we are going to move on to other things. I saw an interview with Paul McCartney and Mary McCartney, his daughter, OK? Now, Paul McCartney doesn't give many interviews, and, you know, I thought, that's strange, why has he done this? And I thought, it must be to push his new book, Lyrics, which I also received over Christmas, which is another wonderful piece of, you know, Beatles memorabilia. And I thought he must be pushing his book. And it was one of these sort of, you know, father talks about, you know, Paul talks about Mary, Mary talks about her dad. It was one of those Sunday Times type things. And then at the end, it said, Mary McCartney serves it up, is available on Discovery. So Paul McCartney, as a father, decided to give a very, very rare interview, not to promote his own book, Lyrics, or to promote the Beatles tapes. He did it purely for his daughter to promote what she's doing. Mary McCartney serves it up. And I thought, well, what a lovely gesture from a father to try and help his daughter, you know?
It's what any of us would do. I mean, you know, anyone in a position to give somebody a little encouragement, why wouldn't he? You know the McCartney album, the one with the cherries on the front?
Yes.
The one he did straight after he left the Beatles.
The cherries were on the back, actually. I'm sorry to be pedantic.
Well, whichever way around.
Yeah,
so the other picture on the other side.
On the front, yeah.
With him with a baby tucked inside his jacket.
Yes.
That's Mary McCartney.
I know. It's absolutely wonderful, isn't it? When you look at that
great
picture.
Great picture.
That little baby's head just peeping out from that sort of fur coat that Paul's got on. And then there he is. And she reveals in this, by the way, honestly, you learn something new about the Beatles every day. She says, oh, my dad has an exercise routine every morning and finishes it off with a faultless, unsupported five-minute headstand. Crikey, I couldn't do a five-second headstand. I don't know about you.
I couldn't even do a one-second headstand.
No,
I mean, no. I'd probably die if I tried. No, that's amazing. I mean, he is extraordinary. He's pushing 80.
Yeah.
And I've seen him close up in recent years.
Sure.
He looks like a young man.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And just to finish on this, because, of course, we do like to mention the Beatles, but not to a huge extent.
Not to piss everybody off.
Exactly. Although, if it's the year of Beatlemania, then presumably we've got a mass support for all this. But she said when they were kids, when she was about 11 or 12, they'd be watching something on telly, and their dad, Paul McCartney, would be strumming on his guitar, writing, you know, another new record like Mull of Kintyre or something. And they all turned around and told him to shut up because he's watching the telly. And Paul says in this piece, you know, he said, I reflected later that not many people in the world, without sounding big-headed, would have turned around and told one of the Beatles to shut up. It's very funny, isn't it?
I mean, that is so grounding, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's wonderful because it shows, as if we didn't know already, that he's just as human as the rest of us.
Yeah, all that happened on his farm in Scotland, Mull of Kintyre, where he went to sort of get his head together after the Beatles split up, of course. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, we've talked about trainers in the past and, you know, people have obsessions with them, but I can't believe the latest strange, weird craze about trainers, which are now being sold amongst youngsters, which, and the more like soil and mud they've got on them, the better, because that mud and soil, it is claimed, came from some great rock festival or something like that. I mean, has the world gone completely mad?
Of course. I looked at the calendar thinking, is this April the 1st when I read this?
Yeah.
Because it's completely stupid. Anyone could get that mud from anywhere.
Exactly.
Just walk down the garden, get some mud, slap it on and say that it's from the hallowed Wembley turf or wherever it's supposed to be from. Well, I mean, if anyone falls for that, they are a complete dunce.
Yeah, I just don't get it. Having said that, of course, as we said in the past, you know, trainers are big business. I saw this piece here. One of the most expensive trainers in the world. And it says, last April, the first pair of Nike Air Yeezy Eye sneakers worn by Kanye West He's the rock star, isn't he? Kanye West, yeah?
Was the one married to, was married to Kim Kardashian?
Yes, I think so. That's right, yeah. At the 2008 Grammys, broke the world record when they were sold this week for £1.4 million to a private buyer. I mean, honestly, you know, the
unbelievable. They might not even have been his. They could have been some old trainers that belonged to the cleaner or something, you know?
No, I totally agree.
Are folk that gullible still in this day and age?
Yeah, I don't think they even have his name on it. I've got some football memorabilia. So if I've got Wayne Rooney's first England shirt, at least it says, you know, England versus Australia, and it's signed by Wayne Rooney. I've got a pair of John Terry boots, which he wore as captain of England against, I think it was Greece. But it's actually stitched into the, you know, the leather, you know, John Terry, and there's a flag of England, the flag of Greece on it, and all that kind of stuff. But these, I've seen a picture of them. You're absolutely right. They simply could have been anybody's, and nobody quite knows how you can, you know, claim its authenticity. But there we are.
Well, I lost faith in rock memorabilia
back
in the late 80s when I heard from one of Freddie Mercury's entourage that a whole team of them would sit down and autograph letters and programs and so on in Freddie Mercury's name, and then they would sell them off. So there were thousands of these things, and they didn't even have Freddie's name on.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I don't think it's any secret to tell people that David Beckham had a huge team of people signing things for him, led by his sisters, because his sisters were at least the same family, you know what I mean? And they could write David Beckham's, you know, signature like it was his and all that. And I'm not accusing
him. But it wasn't his. It wasn't his.
Well,
and that actually takes all those people who paid money for them for complete mugs.
To be honest,
I think it's an appalling thing to do.
Well, no, to be honest, because I've got to defend the Beckham family. I'm not accusing them of fraud or anything like that. They were usually sent out to people who just wrote in and asked for autographs. You know what I mean? So I don't think anybody's quite being defrauded. But the volume of stuff that you get when you're a star and people who want autographs, you either reject it all or you make an arrangement to send them back something that's signed. And I think it's better to send them back something that's signed, isn't it? In the belief that then the fan thinks they've got a, you know, an autograph from the star, and they put it in a frame, put it on the wall and all that kind of stuff.
I can't believe you just said that.
Really?
It's an absolute con. If somebody sends something to you, Mike Parry, and says, I would love to have Mike Parry's autograph, you sign it personally.
Yeah.
And you send it back.
Yeah.
If your cleaner signs it, or if I sign it,
or
if you get your sister to sign it,
that's
not Mike Parry's signature.
Yeah, but the people who are getting it don't know that, do they?
Yeah, well, that makes it even worse.
Well, it doesn't, because at least...
Yes, it compounds the fracture.
Yeah.
It is saying that they've been conned, and it's laughing at them behind their back. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I think this is disgusting behaviour.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I feel sort of two ways about it. When I was about 8... I wrote to Everton Football Club, to the goalkeeper, Gordon West, because I loved Gordon West, because he used to wear a flat cap, a Peaky Blinders hat, as we'd call it today, OK?
Well, you still wear those now.
Well, I do, actually. I've got a new one for Christmas.
I saw it.
Yeah. Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
They do suit you, I have to say.
Well, you know, if you're a man of a certain age and the hair's thinning a bit, it's not just a fashion item. It's a kind of... I think a head looks better when it's got hair on it. If it hasn't got hair on it, it should have a cap on it. And if it's got a cap on it, I think it looks okay.
Does it keep your head warm?
No, it keeps it too hot. I often No.
Get one and you can put ice cubes under it.
Yeah, get an ice cube under it. That's right. No, seriously, after I've walked a bit, you know, because I still like walking, I have to take it off and carry it because your head does get very hot. And a number of times I've nearly lost my cap by leaving it on the table in a pub or something, you know what I mean, or the back of a chair or something, and then, you know, and you run back and get it. But fortunately, I've never lost it, considering my Peaky Blinder hats are genuine hats. First one ever.
Yeah, you see, they need to be genuine, so do the autograph.
Yeah, well, you're right. Anyway, going back to Gordon West, I wrote to Everton, you know, in my schoolboy handwriting, so it must have looked very kind of childish, because I was a child, I suppose. And I couldn't believe it. A week later, a brown paper envelope came through the door, and it was a black and white picture to my best wishes, Gordon West, and I've still got it. I mean, it's, you know, it's wrinkled and faded now, but I've still got it, and it's one of my proudest possessions because it goes back so far, you know?
I think that authenticity counts for a huge amount in life. There isn't very much that is authentic anymore. Something like an autograph needs to be genuine.
Yeah.
Imagine me doing one of my book signings.
Yes.
And having a whole team of people sitting there signing copies of the book instead of people standing there patiently to have me sign it.
Yes.
I'm absolutely no one. I'm just a humble scribe. But I think people would feel shortchanged if they thought that I hadn't signed that book myself.
Yeah, well, I agree. But, I mean, that's very public. A book signing, you sign them. I've done book signings with Mr. Brazil when, you know, we wrote two books, Life Story of Alan Brazil and the follow-up and all that kind of stuff. And amazingly, because we were both working on the radio at the time, both doing the breakfast show on Talk Sport, I just went along, really, with Al after we'd finished the breakfast show, and I was just sitting around in the back of the bookshop, and all of a sudden, people started bringing Al's book to me and getting me to sign it, which I thought was very touching, very nice, except I wasn't the subject of the book. I'd just written it. But no, you're absolutely right. There is something quite, yeah, something quite compelling about it, isn't there? Sign a book that's got your name on it, I have to say, and you've done much of that. Talking about books, Miss Jones, how's the latest one coming along?
Almost done.
Right.
I submit on Friday.
Submit to what, Miss Jones? Please, it's a family show.
I submit my manuscript to my publisher. See. What are right. you like?
Yeah. Right. Go on, yeah.
It has been a slog. It's been a year and a bit now.
Yeah.
And I say this every time. Every book I write is the hardest one I've ever done.
Yes.
Seems to be getting harder. Maybe that's something to do with the fact that we're getting older and our energy levels decrease more rapidly. I can't write in the evening, for example, anymore.
Right. Oh, really?
Which I always used to be able to do, but I can't anymore.
Yeah.
Can't see properly, can't concentrate.
Golly. Seen a doctor about that, Miss Jones?
Have
you seen a doctor about that condition, debilitating condition?
I think it's just normal people in the real world don't work at night anyway, do they? Unless they are night workers.
Well, sure, no.
But the thing about writing is it's not just sitting there tapping away. It has to come from somewhere. And the brain gets very tired towards the end of the day.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. Totally agree with that, indeed. What do you think about, I don't think we've talked about this since it happened, but a lady called April Ashley's died. And what a fascinating person she was. I read her life story, you know, a number of obituaries, and she was the very first sort of real transgender person, born a boy, grew up as a woman, turned into an incredibly beautiful woman, and romanced some of the world's most handsome and famous men. I mean, this is all a mystery to me, this transgender business. You know, I of course, I empathise and sympathise with people caught in that sort of very, very difficult situation, but her story was truly astonishing.
Yeah, it was a bit before my time. But
yeah, mine.
You know, we're so used to the transgender scenario these days, and quite rightly. Must have been torture for people in the past. And many people now who don't have the resources or the opportunities to change their gender if they wish to.
Yeah.
But imagine being born into the wrong body.
Yes. Yes, it must have been shocking, absolutely shocking, and to have fought all the prejudices, you know, that came away. And you're absolutely right, in those days, the world was a lot less understanding even than it is now. So, you know.
I remember having this conversation with, you know who I mean, by Lady Colleen Campbell.
Yes, Colleen Campbell, she calls herself, doesn't she?
Yes.
Yeah.
She spent the first 15 years of her life as a boy.
Yeah.
And going to a boys' boarding school. She was born and raised in Jamaica. And in the 1940s, when she was born, as she explained, if in doubt, when the child is born, if there are aberrations, let's say, in the knicker department,
yes,
that if the doctor was in doubt about what gender of baby he was handling, the baby would be put down as a boy.
Golly.
So she was raised as a boy until she got to the point where it became obvious through puberty that actually she was female.
Yeah.
So she had to have some surgery to adjust various parts of her body.
Golly.
And she became a woman, which she was already in the first place.
Yes.
So imagine the kind of upbringing she had. I mean, how traumatic that must all have been.
Absolutely traumatic. Talking about trauma, Miss Jones, and I hate to dwell on private grief, but we haven't had a chance to talk about it because it happened over Christmas, but your very good friend, the First Lady Radio 1 DJ, sadly lost her life, and I believe her funeral's coming up soon. Is that right?
Oh, poor Janice Long. Yeah, it's so sad. I didn't even know she was ill. She was one of the nicest people in broadcasting, in media.
Yeah.
People say, what was her secret? And the secret was very simple. She was exactly the same on the screen as she was off it.
Right.
So she didn't put on any act, yeah, any airs and graces. Mm. She was wildly enthusiastic about music. She loved discovering new bands, new artists. She gave people breaks.
Mm-hmm.
She was one of the first people to put on her radio shows, people like Amy Winehouse and Adele.
Yeah.
You know, she played their music before they had recording contracts, before they were released and so on. She had very humble beginnings. She worked in a newsagent's. She lived in Liverpool, of course.
Yeah.
And she managed to get herself into BBC Radio Merseyside,
mm-hmm,
just on a sort of adding to a regular programme. And
yep,
at one point she interviewed Paul Gambaccini.
Right.
And he was so impressed by her infectious enthusiasm and,
mm-hmm,
and her knowledge about music.
Yeah.
That he was the one who recommended her to BBC Radio 1.
Right.
And she landed a Monday to Thursday evening slot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is interesting. I read in so many reports about Janice's passing,
mm,
that she was the first female presenter on BBC Radio 1.
Yeah.
Well, that wasn't true.
It was Annie Nightingale.
It was Annie Nightingale.
That's what I always thought, yeah.
And Annie Nightingale started off on Sunday nights in about 1970.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people who wrote these reports just didn't do their homework.
Yeah, all my life I thought, oh, Annie Nightingale, first female DJ ever. And I was very surprised when Janice was credited with that achievement. Although Annie Nightingale's still alive, isn't she? I think I saw her speak about Janice.
Yeah, she is. She's living back in Maida Vale now, I think.
Oh, right.
Her husband died a couple of years ago.
Oh, right, okay.
But she's in her 80s and,
yeah,
she's still going.
Yeah.
I did a TV show with her not long ago.
Oh, so, excellent, yeah. Have you ever, by the way, heard of a woman called Barbara Sharone?
Yeah, I know Barbara very well.
Well, it says here that she's about to publish a book and it's going to blow the lid off, you know, another load of terrible secrets inside the pop industry.
This is a bit worrying. When publicists turn around and do their memoirs, you know, it sort of breaks the code of trust,
right,
between them and their artists,
mm-hmm,
down all the years. And knowing Barbara, she's been a very private person all her career.
Right.
And she's never betrayed confidences.
Mm-hmm.
Something must have happened to make her do this.
Oh, I see. Or, well, maybe she just needs the money and she's getting a bit older like all of us and decided to cash in or something. I mean,
that could well be the case. But I mean,
yeah,
she spent 3 years living with Keith Richards when she was writing his autobiography or his biography.
Yeah.
She looked after Madonna for years and years,
mm-hmm,
when Madonna was signed to Warner's.
Mm.
She and a colleague called Moira Bellis,
yeah,
looked after Madonna. They were so close that they were involved in the birth of her baby and all that kind of thing.
Mm.
So, yes, the stories that Barbara has to tell are explosive.
Mm.
I'm just really surprised that she's telling them.
Yeah, well, amazing. Well, talking about the showbiz world, of course, you had a great showbiz experience, didn't you, over the pantomime season?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, yes, you did. You certainly did. And your son, Henry, made a star of himself, didn't he? So are we all now hoping for greater things to come?
Henry's already got a new job. He's about to leave the country at the end of the month.
Oh, yeah, where's he
and
going?
And he will be touring the cities of Italy in an Elvis musical.
An Elvis musical?
Yeah.
That's amazing. He doesn't play Elvis, does he?
No, it's a very small cast. There's about six of them in the cast and they sort of rotate.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I haven't seen it yet, haven't read the script, but he acquitted himself so well in this panto. I mean, I would say that, wouldn't I?
Of course you would, yeah, yeah.
All I don't push my kids.
Mm.
I do encourage them and I am there for them. I've got three children
and
I believe that I treat them all the same. I support all their efforts to do whatever they do to get on in their lives.
Yeah.
But there is something incredibly special about seeing your child who has worked so hard and who has trained themselves to the point that they break their knees and they bleed and all kinds of other things.
Yeah.
To actually see them up there doing what they're trained to do and what they love, it's indescribable.
That's brilliant. I don't suppose it's the Tim Vine production of Elvis, is it, that Henry's involved with? Because my mate Tim Vine, Jeremy Vine's brother, is in I think it's a one-man Elvis show at the Dominion Theatre, I think, in London.
Yeah, no, it's not going to be that one. There are six people in this cast.
Oh, okay.
But the interesting thing for me is that they're they're performing it in English,
yeah,
in Italy.
Oh.
So it's slightly complicated. I will go and see it. I'll probably find somewhere like Florence if it's going there.
Well, that's brilliant. Yeah, get out there and watch it. Just one cornetto.
I don't think Elvis did that one, did he?
Give it to me. Well, he should then. They should incorporate that into the song, shouldn't they? Listen, that's what I was going to talk to you about. I don't know whether you saw it over Christmas, but Alec Baldwin, of course, has got himself into a terrible mess with this terrible tragedy that happened on the set of the film he was making, and the director of photography or director of the show died. He put out a picture over Christmas. I know Christmas has now come and gone, but the repercussions of it are still reverberating, of him and his wife and their six children all sitting there smiling. It was terribly tasteless.
I thought so too. Look, lovely that he's got a pretty young wife and six gorgeous little children.
But yeah,
there is a family grieving for the loss of a mother and a cherished wife. There's all the friends and extended family of poor Helena. Mm. This is still unresolved. It's far from resolved.
Oh, absolutely.
And heads will roll over this.
Well, you know, as we've said before, not wishing to go back over old territory, but he was accredited as being a co-producer of the show. And being a producer of the show means you take responsibility for the making of it or the breaking of it. And so there are questions to be answered, without doubt.
Not only that, and I don't want to damn the guy before the trial, as it were, but...
No.
Alec Baldwin was the guy holding the gun.
Yes, that's right.
He was the guy who shot the bullet, whether he realised there was a bullet in that gun or not.
Well, he's...
I would have said that the buck stops with him.
I'd have thought so, except he says he was, you know, given the gun and it was said, oh, it's a cold gun, which means it's not loaded and all kind of stuff. But look, who knows? And we can't prejudge whatever is going to happen there. I tell you what, Amanda Holden can't do wrong in anything she does, can she? She's, you know, she's terrifically popular on television as a judge and celebrity shows and all that kind of stuff. She runs a radio show, a very successful one, gets paid very highly for it. And now her 15-year-old daughter, Lexi, who's very beautiful from the pictures I've seen, is about to emerge as the next great talent in the modelling world. I would say, actually, that, you know, that family is very gifted, but is it too young to, you know, to pitch your daughter into the world of, you know, high celebrity modelling at the age of 15?
You took the words right out of my mouth. 15 is far too young.
Yeah.
Lexi should be at school. She should be doing her GCSEs and her A-levels. And she should be pausing that modelling career, which will still be there when she graduates from school. Mm. Now is not the time. 15, oh, it's far too young. They see things in the modelling world that you cannot unsee.
Mm.
And they don't want to be pushing her down that track at this stage in the game. My son Henry is 24,
right,
and is slightly different.
Mm, mm.
You know, I just think they've got to get through their education and consolidate their opportunities and then decide what they're going to do to make a living.
Yeah, but if, you know, if the opportunity's there and a mother put her foot down and said, no, you're not taking it, I mean, she could get terribly resentful later on if somebody else of the same age, you know, 15, 16, suddenly grasped the opportunity and becomes very famous and very rich. It's a bit of a conundrum for a parent, I think. I mean, obviously, we've seen, you know, the way other people have worked out. McCulkin, what's his name? Corey McCulkin?
Macaulay Culkin.
Thank you, Macaulay Culkin and all that kind of stuff. He kind of blazed very brightly and then sort of disappeared off the face of the earth. His brother actually is now much more famous than him because his brother was in one of the world's most successful ever TV series, Succession. I don't suppose you've seen that, have you, Miss Jones?
That's another one that's on the list to flop out on the couch and catch up on.
Oh, you've got to see it, honestly.
I'm going to. Yeah. I just haven't had time.
No, I know. But I know you're a great television watcher, but it is one of the most sensational series of all times. Talking about stars, by the way, in the comeback, and I don't think we've talked about this, although we've talked about it off air, Charlotte Church is making a comeback. What happened to Charlotte Church 10 years ago?
Well, I mean, this is a bad idea, I think. Charlotte Church's USP was that she was a little girl who sang opera like an adult.
Yeah, yeah, right.
But she grew up and she tried a pop career, so she completely threw opera off the side and tried to be a pop star. That didn't work.
Mm.
It went nowhere at all. She's done a couple of comebacks prior to this, so what? I really just feel that she's had her day.
Yeah, well, you know, it's sad that really. She's a real Welsh girl. I don't think she ever moved from her roots. I think she lives in a place called Mumbles, which is a very upmarket area of Swansea, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a suburb of Swansea where, oh, what's her name? He's married to Michael Douglas. Catherine Zeta-Jones. Oh, yes. They've got a house there. Oh, it is a very nice part of the world, yeah.
Yeah, no, it is. I know her ex-husband better than I know her.
Gavin Henson,
who was once voted the world's best young rugby player. You know, you get like Footballer of the Year, Young Footballer of the Year. Well, he got Young Rugby Player of the Year, you know, and he was an enormous talent. And he played for Ospreys, right? Which I think is I'm not big on rugby in Wales, but I think it's the Swansea rugby team. But the reason I know him is we were going to Cardiff one time to do a live show. And we got on the train at Paddington Station. And, you know, I can't quite remember why, but the Ospreys team got on. They were going back to Wales. So the train goes to Cardiff, then I think goes on to Swansea. And Gavin Henson was there. And it's safe to say that the boys had had a few sherbets after the game they'd been playing that day or whatever. And honestly, it was very unpleasant to be in the same carriage as them, if you see what I mean.
Oh, dear. That's not good. But he was quite a pretty boy, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And he, unfortunately, he was good-looking enough to receive offers to do other things than playing rugby. So his career ended early, and he went off and did things like trekked across the North Pole or something, you know, for one of these TV shows, which took him away. And whilst I'm not accusing him of having wasted his career, his impact on the game of rugby went south as his fame and his fortune went north. And then, of course, when the fame and the fortune burnt out, there was a bit of a wreck of a rugby career left in the ashes. You see what I mean?
Yeah, you don't hear anything about him now.
No, you don't. It's funny you should say that, but you don't. You'd have thought that, you know, he'd have emerged somewhere else doing something else or, you know, popping up on TV sport shows or something. But you're right, you don't. So, I don't know, maybe he's rebuilt and recycled his life.
Not everybody can have that pundit career. Not everybody's got the intelligence, the articulacy, the wit, the sort of quick riposte, you know. It takes a genuine talent to be able to do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Do you remember Sally Gunnell after whichever Olympics it was?
Yes.
They tried to launch her as a television pundit.
Yes, I do.
And it failed miserably because she was incapable of interviewing athletes.
Do you know what? You're so right there. Everybody thinks that, all you've got to do is sit in a comfortable chair in front of a TV camera and all of a sudden you're a pundit or you're a commentator or something like that. But you're so right. Loads of people have tried it. Loads of people have failed. You know, the ones who stick it out are those who, you're quite right, A, work very hard at it, and B, have that certain talent for communication. It's not always about, you know, saying the right thing at the right time. It's communicating with people.
It is that, and it's also having the back knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, somebody like Gary Lineker is brilliant at this.
Yes.
Ian Wright is also very good.
Yeah, Wright is terrific.
You've got to have that history behind you
and
that knowledge of the game going way back that you can make comparisons with things that are happening right now with things that happened back then and be able to sift all those things through your brain very, very rapidly and to be able to come up with questions spontaneously. It's not just a question of somebody giving you a list of questions and you just read them out.
Yeah, no.
The other talent is listening to the answers and then making your next question pertinent to whatever they said.
Yeah.
And somebody who's just reading it off a list can't possibly do that. They can't manage that because they're not thinking about it.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Thinking is a talent in that scenario.
Yeah, well, that's where Piers was and will be so very good at what he does. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, yes. He'll be brilliant.
Such a bright guy. And
he is.
So able to...
We are big Piers Morgan fans.
Well, we are, and he's about to relaunch his career. Eamon Holmes has relaunched a new career on GB News as the breakfast show host. And my goodness me, Eamon's had longevity in his career, in his life, hasn't he, in his working life. He's been on so many breakfast shows. He's covered everything. But anyway, there we are. Just finally, Miss Jones, and I always say that we shouldn't go on about the Beatles all the time, but a guy called Dennis O'Brien has died.
Oh, yeah, he did. Poor old Dennis.
Did you know him?
No.
No, good old Dennis, yeah, but no. Well, I'm sure he was a good old Dennis, yeah. I'm sure he was. But anyway, he was an accountant who took charge of George Harrison's affairs when George Harrison was struggling, helped him found Handmade Films. They made all the Monty Python films and all that kind of stuff. But then, unfortunately, the tide turned, as it very often does, and George ended up writing a song called Lion O'Brien because there was a question mark over a sum of money within the relationship, which has seemingly never been resolved. It happens to a lot of pop stars, that sort of thing, doesn't it?
Doesn't it always happen? Yeah, it's dodgy when you've got a songwriter who can make his disgruntlement so public.
Yes,
exactly. In that way, because you can never get away from that.
No, you're definitely right. You can't. Right, okay, Miss Jones. Well, thank you very much indeed. Thank you to all the millions of listeners out there who've tuned in again to listen to the views and the feelings and passions of Miss Jones, the rock chick writer, and myself. And folks, we'll be back with you again this time next week.
I never knew this. I thought that Thomas's remains were in Canterbury Cathedral.
So did I. And in fact, I think I've seen them. I went to a wedding once in Canterbury years and years ago, and we had a couple of hours to spare, you know, before the wedding. So instead of languishing in the pub, we thought we'd go and have a look around. I could swear I saw a plaque on the wall inside Canterbury Cathedral saying, "Here lie the remains of, the saint who founded Christianity in this country."
Well, I think what we've seen is a plaque, because I've seen it as well.
Yeah.
But I don't think there are any remains behind it, which is a bit worrying, isn't it?
It is a bit worrying, I have to say, yeah. But anyway, there you go. Who will rid me of this, what was it? What was the word in the Shakespeare play? Who will rid me of this troubled priest or something? No, who will rid me of this troublesome priest? That was it, wasn't it?
Somebody will tell us, no doubt.
Yeah, of course they will, yeah. And then, of course, the king's favourite knights thought that the king was giving them a sort of nod and a wink. Can you go and get rid of him? And rode off down to Canterbury and unfortunately massacred him, which the king regretted for the rest of his life, didn't he? But anyway, look, that's a history lesson, which I'm sure our listeners do not need. They probably know more about it than we do, absolutely right.
They will let us know, yeah, I know.
Oh, they will. They always do. Talking about books, Miss Jones, how's the latest one coming along?
Almost done.
Right.
I submit on Friday.
Mm-hmm. Submit to what, Miss Jones? Please, it's a family show.